This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Nashville's Big Backyard is an economic and tourism initiative encompassing a natural watershed region that winds through the Natchez Trace National Parkway in Tennessee's southwest quarter. In this third installment, Exploring Nashville's Big Backyard, we'll stop in at the legendary Muscle Shoals Sound Studio in Sheffield, Alabama. The studio opened back in 1969. And was quickly marking up the charts with number one hits by the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Rod Stewart, Paul Simon, and many more legendary recording artists. Next up is a visit with Sandra Burroughs, Executive Director at the Alabama Music Hall of Fame in Tuscumbia, Alabama. Burroughs is also mayor of the nearby village of Lexington, Alabama, and she just couldn't resist sharing funny anecdotes about her mayoral duties in the town of 750 residents. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we explore Nashville's Big Backyard.
Terrell Benton, Muscle Shoals Sound Studio, tour guide in Sheffield, Alabama.
Tell us about the studio and the history of this. This is like second iteration, isn't it?
It is. Area. It is. The Swampers, at that time known as the Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section, 1969, left Fame Studio and came to this little building. This little building was actually built in 1947 by the cemetery across the street. It was a casket showroom.
A second life for the casket.
A second life. The ghosts are good here, though.
Yeah.
You know, but no, the guys came over, and with the help of Jerry Wexler from Atlantic Records, he loaned them the initial money to come in. They put a little of their own money in it, and they came over and started working here in April of 1969.
Just so incredible to me. Just give us five of the top bands and performers who performed here, and that'll set the stage.
Bob Seger, Paul Simon, Rolling Stones, Rod Stewart, Willie Nelson. We could go on and on.
How incredible that they sought out this studio. This wasn't the reverse.
No, this little studio, you know, was the only studio in the country where the musicians actually owned it. I think that was part of it. These four young men at that time when they moved over had a dream, and they came over, and through the help of Jerry Wexler and their own absolute talent.
And that group of musicians, they were called the Swampers.
The Swampers, yeah.
And talk to us about the backstory of the Swampers and how they started out and came to be here and not there.
Well, in the mid-60s, they went to work for Rick Hall at Fame Studio, and they were actually known as the Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section. The backing band for Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, Clarence Carter, Etta James. And then they decided to step out on their own. And with the help of Jerry Wexler, who was the vice president of Atlantic Records, he was actually the man that had brought Aretha and Wilson Pickett over to Fame. They came to this little building, and he continued to help these young men for years and years.
So he was the funding, the financier for this operation?
He certainly was. Yeah. He sure was. Yep. He actually, I believe, it was like $18,000 he loaned them, which was a sum of money in 1969.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah.
Yep. That's what my dad earned in a year.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, they came over, and obviously, you know, Jerry had such a tremendous background. You know, he was actually a journalist.
Oh, interesting. Did not know.
He had joined the military in World War II and then went to Kansas State. And here was a kid from Washington Heights, New York. Went back to New York, eventually got a job as a writer for Billboard. He is the man that invented the phrase rhythm and blues. He wrote a weekly column.
It was called
race records.
Race
on,
records,
right?
Absolutely, and yeah. He was highly offended. Years later, he said he wished that he had called it something else, but Rhythm and Blues Today was the title of his weekly article for Billboard.
And Rhythm and Blues still exists.
Absolutely. It certainly does. It certainly does. Yeah. Yep. He went to Atlantic Records, became the vice president, became a part owner in the company, and then started off by signing folks like Ray Charles, the Coasters, the Drifters, wow. On and on.
Back to here. Talk to us about some of the other seminal performers and groups that came here.
I think the thing that mainly pops out is the Staple Singers. I'll Take You There, Respect Yourself. These four young men, the Swampers, were pivotal in that change from gospel to pop for the Staple Singers. And Rod Stewart left here with two number one albums. Wow. In fact, Rod still refers to the building as the tiny little room with the colored lights. Leonard Skinner, Jimmy Johnson of the Swampers, was the man that brought them here initially. We could go on and on and on. Paul Simon, it's a fascinating array and a diverse array. One of the biggest selling reggae records of all time was Jimmy Cliff's The Harder They Come, and part of that album was done in this building as well.
In this studio, in the room we're in right now.
Yes, sir.
And basically everything we see is it was.
It certainly is. We worked very hard after the documentary Muscle Shoals came out, and with some outside grants and funding, we were able to recreate it exactly as it was.
So you even repainted.
Yes, yes, we did. Yes, we did. Yeah. I think that initially, when they were putting the studio back together, a video crew came in with Jimmy and David and Roger of the Swampers and basically said, is that the correct yellow? Is that the correct
right,
red?
Right.
Yep, absolutely.
The other thing that amazes me, this is probably the 10th studio I've been in between Memphis, Nashville, and down here. I was so naive, thinking that all you guys would have all of the high-tech, state-of-the-art acoustic baffles and whatnot, and this is so funky. Basically 70s, man.
It is. Well, when the guys first moved in, they realized it was a tin roof. So they went and bought burlap, and housing insulation came in and wrapped it up the first weekend they were here in April of 69. The cement block portions of the walls, the sound would just bounce and fracture. So the styrofoam pieces are actually what the glass part of your electric meter would come in, and they identified which ones had the issues. So all of these hits were burlap and styrofoam.
That's so funny. And here it is.
Here it is.
And that's part of the magic, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
Part of what makes that sound what it is.
It is. This little room, I know when a session starts here now, the walls come alive.
Mm-hmm.
You can feel it. The hair on your arms will stand up. It's that intense in this little room.
Isn't it fascinating how important those environmental, acoustic, atmospheric elements are that you think and you look at and they appear static, but they're very much dynamic and alive.
They are alive. This little room is alive. The corners will bounce off each other.
Mm-hmm. You don't even have any baffles in your corners.
No. We'll move a couple. We had a session here last December, and after about the first track, the producer walked out and said, that corner's bouncing off this corner, so we move the baffle over. It makes the artist work hard, and I think that's one of the keys to the hits. Absolutely.
Interesting. A little bit more about some of the seminal performers in the past, right, and then moving into today. You're still going.
We're still going. Well, of course, the first artist to come to the building was Cher. Jerry Wexler at Atlantic had signed her to a solo contract. The next artist in was a young lady that back in 67 had had one of the biggest hits in the world, Lulu, To Sir With Love.
And
that was
the hit
huge. There's a little hit off this record they did here called Oh Me Oh My, I'm a Fool for You Baby. And then shortly after that, Boz Scaggs came. And one of the key elements in the Boz Scaggs album, it was his second solo record. His first record had actually only been distributed in Japan. The key element to that, besides the Swampers, was the addition of Dwayne Allman on guitar. Dwayne played many sessions in this building. In fact, one of his last sessions before his death was actually in this building.
Oh, interesting. And so, going forward, his brother, Greg?
Greg never recorded in the building. And according to what David has told me, most of the Allman Brothers were in this building. But Greg never recorded in this building. He did his last record before he passed away at Fame, though.
Okay.
Yep, sure did.
Okay, let's push into the here and now.
Here and now, we have a connection with Duane Allman. The Allman Betts Band, Greg's son, Dickie's son, and Barry's son, have done both of their albums here, one in November of 19 and one in last December. It was a heritage thing. These kids walked in, and Barry Oakley looked at me one day and said, I walk in the back door and the hair on the arm still stands up. It was just funky and comfortable enough. And they also had wanted to record directly to analog tape, just like the old days.
Yep.
And so we were able to accommodate that. So it was a fascinating 6 days last December, really.
And that's the other thing. You got all this digital technology, and yet some of the purists love the tube technology.
Absolutely.
To this day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the board that we have back there is a 1969 board. It was actually hand-built for Chet Atkins.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a little 16-track API machine. It's absolutely one of the funkiest things in the world, you know. One of the other bands that we're really proud of, Dave Cobb brought down Rival Sons a couple of years ago, and their last album was actually nominated for a Grammy last year, and that was a fun thing to be around.
Yeah.
Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys came down, and as well as Chris Stapleton. So it's still active and still going.
What's on the horizon?
Oh, well, we have a few sessions set up. We did a session last Saturday. Nicole Atkins had done her last solo record here, and she'd also done a little EP a few months ago. But she came in last Saturday with David from the Swampers, Kelvin Holly, a local guitar player that had played with Little Richard for years, and she had Audley Freed that had been in the Black Crowes. They did two songs for a benefit that was put together by Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead. It was videotaped, and I believe you can actually go online and still see them recording the two songs that they did online right now.
How would you find that?
Oh, gosh. You can go to the rexfoundation.org, and they'll give you the directions to it.
Talk about the Rolling Stones for a moment. That's incredible.
Well, the Stones had initially wanted to record in L.A. or Memphis. They were touring the States. Well, they didn't have the visas required to record in America, so L.A. and Memphis said no to that. But Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records said, got this little place in Alabama. He was actually trying to sign the Stones to Atlantic, and he did. Well, the Stones came in on December 2nd of 69, and the first night they were here, they recorded You Gotta Move. The second night, Brown Sugar. And the third night, Wild Horses.
Wow.
It's not a bad 3 days.
Yeah, right here.
Right here.
In the one room.
In the one room. And as a matter of fact, the lyric and the arrangement for Wild Horses were written in the little bathroom here. Probably the only studio in the world with a bathroom in the live room, but that's what
worked.
You deal with. It worked.
Where did they stay?
They actually stayed at the Holiday Inn in downtown Florence, Alabama. The Wexler actually wrote up the contract for them to sign with Atlantic Records in the restaurant at the Holiday Inn.
Very, very cool.
The piano.
Yeah.
They bought this little piano in 1970 and brought it over. You know that piano intro to Bob Seger's Old Time Rock and Roll? That's the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Main Street, We've Got Tonight, Rock and Roll Never Forgets. As a matter of fact, Old Time Rock and Roll was written by one of their staff songwriters, a man named George Jackson. He had one other big hit, One Bad Apple for the Osmonds. This is also the piano that you hear on Kodachrome, Paul Simon. Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night. And it's also the piano where a roadie from Lynyrd Skynyrd sat one day while everyone was at lunch. They came back from lunch, and this roadie, who was a classically trained pianist, had used his time well. He had written Freebird on this piano while they were at lunch.
I'm as free
I think last summer there were 4 TV commercials in prime time. On 3 of the commercials, it was the Swampers and this piano. On the other, it was just the Swampers.
I love it. Somebody wanted to learn more. Where would you direct them?
We do tours Tuesday through Saturday. The first tour is at 10:30 in the morning. The last is at 3:30. And you can go to our website, MuscleShoalsSoundStudios.org, and look at our merchandise, check on tour times. And actually, also, there's a recording tab on there. If you're interested in recording, you can submit what you're planning on doing. Terrell Benton, Muscle Shoals Sound Studio, tour guide in Sheffield, Alabama.
Hey, I'm Sandra Burroughs with the Alabama Music Hall of Fame in Tuscumbia, Alabama.
Who would have guessed? Major mecca for American music right here. This is really fascinating.
Thank you so much. We are really proud of our museum here. We've been open since 1990, and the hits just keep coming, and so do the stars.
The roots of music here in this area of Alabama.
It all started, I would guess, in the early 60s when a few recording studios opened up. You know, them just playing around with old equipment, and most of the time it was just stuff that they just had on hand that they used to start recording songs with. And things increased and got better as time went on, and, you know, hits started coming out of the Muscle Shoals area just left and right, and people started taking notice of, hey, where did you record this at? And I think the dynamics of our area that attracted a lot of folks here was that it was a small area. Not a lot of people would know they were in town, so there's not a lot of hoopla. But as the old story goes, the river, I think, was one of the biggest contributaries of the music. A lot of the artists...
Explain.
Yeah, a lot of the artists seemed to think that there was a song coming from the river itself, and that it just sang to you as you stood on the banks of the Tennessee River.
I've heard stories about that going back to the days of the Cherokee.
Oh, yeah, and they firmly believe that. And, you know, if you've lived here all your life like I have, you know, you take it for granted. Mm-hmm. But when you stop and think about it, especially after the Muscle Shoals movie came out, you stop and think about it, and you put everything in perspective, and it's really true.
Gone down to the river to listen?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of times, yeah. And it does. It soothes the soul, just like music does. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a calming effect or something that sparks a song inside of you, it's still there.
A little bit more about the museum here and time and place. What musicians came? When did they come? Why did they come here?
When the museum started in 1990, we tried to dig back to the earlier. Hank Williams was from Alabama. He's got a big display here, as well as Hank Williams Jr.
How far away from where we're at?
They were in Montgomery.
Okay.
Yeah, they were in Montgomery, yeah.
And that's what about it?
That's about 3.5 hours.
Oh, wow. Oh,
it's only 3 if you're riding with me,
there
but
you
we
go.
Won't we won't talk about all that. But, you know, some of the stars that we do focus on here is Miss Emmylou Harris. Emmylou Harris has so many accolades around her name, and she has a big display here. She's from Alabama. Tammy Wynette is also a star here. And
God, guys are hogging all the stars.
I know. We got them all. Tammy Wynette's from Red Bay, Alabama. There is actually a museum in Red Bay that has a lot of memorabilia and things like that in there. It's called the Red Bay Museum. Also, Percy Sledge, he was a huge name in music, and he was from right up the road here in Leighton, Alabama.
And didn't he start out as like a sharecropper?
He did.
In the cotton fields and singing in the fields, right?
Yes, and that's someone heard him and said, hey, you know, you really sound great. You know, he kind of shrugged it off as, oh, whatever, you know, but he'd been singing all his life. He was just doing what he knew to do and struck stardom from that, from the cotton fields, that's right. And then, of course, the group Alabama, they made a big name for themselves in the late 70s, early 80s, and we actually have one of their old tour buses here in the museum, and it's a big hit with everybody that comes through from young to old. It's their very first tour bus that they had. And you can actually go on the bus and look at how they lived and how they traveled from show to show back in the early 80s. And it's a real unique thing to see. Some of the more known latest stars that we have here features is Mr. Taylor Hicks. Of course, Taylor was winner of American Idol years ago. And we also have a lot of memorabilia from Jason Isbell, Jamie Johnson, Gucci Mane, and Alabama Shakes. Those are all more recent names of things that have actually come and made
these are national headliners.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then every day when somebody comes through the museum, they always leave and they'll say, I didn't know so-and-so was from Alabama. And one of those that's really shocking is that Nat King Cole was from Alabama. He's got a really nice display here. So is Gomer Pyle was what we would call him, but Jim Neighbors is his name, and he's got a display here as well. But we have just a plethora of stars that born and raised in Alabama, and not just the stars, the singers themselves or the bands, but we have so many producers and songwriters that are from Alabama. I mean, they're just as rich and famous as the stars are. We have a lot of those, like, for instance, Chris Tompkins. Chris is a young guy from around this area, from the Green Hill area, and he lives in Nashville now and has written countless number one songs that you hear on the radio every day, such as Drunk on a Plane. That's his. Heard it on the way to work this morning and just had to smile because I thought, well, there's Chris again, you know. But we have a lot of those situations like that.
Okay, you explained part of the magic being the water, but there's got to be more. What role do you think church played for a lot of these people who grew up here?
Well, that's where they learned to sing to start with. That was their first platform. That was their very first any kind of singing in front of people. That was their first experience with that.
So that was pretty common, right?
Still is.
Yeah.
It still is.
Yeah.
You know, you go to church and someone asks you to sing in the choir, then they ask you to sing, you know, solo, and then the next thing you know, you've got, you know, producers looking at you. And with today's technology, you know, the people just have recording studios in their home now. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to pop out a song on an MP3 or whatever and send it to a producer. And, if they buy it, it's great.
A little bit more about the museum, highlights of what somebody would see here, where it is, when it's open, how much.
We are open Tuesday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. However, we do schedule private tours anytime during the week, after hours or before hours. Tickled to death to do private tours anytime. We are located in Tuscumbia, Alabama, right on Highway 72. It's not hard to find us at all. We're a pretty well-known landmark around this area. Mm-hmm. But
do you guys have a website?
We do. It's alamhof.org. That's our website. And of course, we're on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, all the social media sites we're on.
Now it's your turn. I understand that you're mayor of a town here.
I am. I'm the mayor of the town called Lexington, Alabama. It's about 30 miles from here. It's a town of about 850 people. I know all 850 people, and all 850 people know me. So, but I was born and raised there, lived there all my life.
And what have you accomplished? What would you like to accomplish as mayor? Why did you become mayor?
Well, I became mayor because I felt like I had the political connections from the 25, 30 years I've been in tourism. One of my aspects has always been legislative issues, and I'm also interested in politics. So from that, I decided, I think I could get a lot of help for the town of Lexington with my political contacts. Mm-hmm. That's happened. We've gotten several grants, and we've definitely been on the radar a lot more in the last 4 years. But my dad was the mayor there for 12 years when I was growing up, so I kind of knew a little bit about the office. But no one knows till you actually get in there what it's all about.
Right.
So,
but you don't take it too seriously. I've heard some of the rumors of your fun that you have on Facebook.
Well, I've always been a kind of a clown on Facebook. Facebook to me is not a platform for serious material. It's where you see pictures and you share pictures and you tell funny stories or just share things. And then, if the situation occurs that you've got bad news, you can also share it there. I like to be lighthearted on Facebook, and so I try to.
Tell us a story about had to do with alcohol.
We brought up a wet dry referendum in Lexington this past election year. It was in August. It was a wet dry issue, and Lexington has always been dry, and it's always been the wettest little dry town ever, but as an economic standpoint, we really thought that increasing alcohol sales for the city would be a good revenue booster. And we're right on the Alabama-Tennessee state line. And right across the line, it's only about 2 miles from our town, there is a restaurant now that serves alcohol, and they have a package store. And anyway, we brought that up, and I thought we would probably have no opposition much to it, because it's kind of an old thing, you know. But we had several of the local ministers come out and really pose a big opposition to the fact that we were bringing that up. So I just proposed on Facebook one day. I said, hey, if you want it, we'll have it. If you don't, that's fine. But if you're interested, I'll be glad to let you ride with our garbage pickup collection folks. And you'll see about 95% of the town is already drinking. So why shouldn't we make the revenue off of that? And so, you know, from that, it just kind of steamrolled into a, hey, you know, that's a pretty good way to look at it. But I didn't face any backlash from that. And right. I think everybody knows my personality, that I'll pretty much say whatever I want to say. But it will, you know, most of the time. But that was one of those cases where I was like, hey, here it is. Here's the facts. I'm not going to try to, you know, just smooth this over. This is how it is. People are already drinking, so we should get the revenue off of it. And then I explained that in most towns our size, that if a town goes wet, then DUIs and DUI-related accidents actually decrease.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. People are not driving out to get it somewhere and drinking it on the way back and that kind of thing. So, and it's all an education thing. You educate folks on how to act and, you know, you'll have a better outcome.
What is the coolest thing that you've accomplished as mayor that you're most proud of?
Well, we actually got a grant for a new water line, a new water system. From that grant, we started improvements on our water. We actually have a sewer system as well. We have water and sewer, and it's always a pain in our sides. I mean, it's always expensive, but it's an evil necessary. So with that one grant that we got for the water line improvements, we started building on that and increasing our water pressure, and loss of water went way down. We have a crew now at our water department that is top-notch. It's taken 4 years to get us that way, but we have a crew now that is absolutely, I'd put them up against anybody. Our water loss at one time was above 65%, and now we're down below 20%.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So that's my most proud accomplishment right there, is having that percentage decrease, and then, of course, that's more money for the town, and, you know.
Okay. Most frustrating challenge as mayor?
The most frustrating challenge has got to be false information. Again, you go back to Facebook and somebody will, you know, we had a situation this past fall where the school's homecoming parade had been canceled by the Board of Education. And they came to us, some of the parents did, and wanted us to do our own parade. I said, well, you know, we really can't do that because that's in violation of what the school board set forth. And if we get groups from the school involved with a parade that's non-sanctioned by the school, they're still representing the school, and it's going to get the band director and the coaches and the teachers all in trouble. So it got put out that we wanted alcohol in the town, but we didn't want the kids to have a parade. You know, that was the thing.
Yeah. You remind me of another mayor I interviewed recently, and I asked him what he was most frustrated with, and he said similar. He said, keyboard cowboys.
That makes sense. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, at the end of the day, the job of the mayor, it's kind of on a roller coaster. There's peak times, and then there's valleys, and there's peaks and valleys. But it all comes out to, you love the town you live in. You want to do better things for it, and you want to see people succeed and, you know, have your town to grow.
And again, what your role is here at the museum?
I am the executive director here at the Alabama Music Hall of Fame.
And number three, when do you sleep?
I sleep every night. I have to get 6 to 8 hours every single night.
All right, so you do good.
I do. I have to. But yeah. I'll tell you this one quick funny story. Back about 2 years ago, I was on my way home from work, and I had just had one heck of a day. And, I mean, I was just so frustrated with like a million things going on in my mind. And I pulled up next to a lady at a red light in another car, and I looked over at her, and she was just sitting there bawling her eyes out. And normally I would look at her and I'd think, oh, no, what's wrong? Bless her heart. But no, not that day. I looked over at her and I thought, oh, my God, there she is sitting crying. She must be the mayor of a small town somewhere.
I love it.
And then I just pulled away. Look, lady, we've all got our issues, you know.
I love it. All right, so anything you want to add, anything you want to share?
You know, every visit to the Alabama Music Hall of Fame presents itself with a new idea or a new fact that you didn't know before. You can go through this Hall of Fame 100 times, and still, every time you go through, you'll see something new. And we're constantly changing up our museum exhibits and things like that. We're actually stepping into getting more interactive exhibits very soon. We've got the proposal out there, and we're working on that right now. But we're going to get more interactive, and we're going to do more shows here at the Hall of Fame, more concerts, and more actual, we're going to do some more online concerts. But when the pandemic is over with, we're going back, we're going to be having 3 to 4 concerts each year.
They'd be outside
in the field. Yeah, in our outdoor stages. Yeah.
That's so cool. To learn more about you and Mayor and about the museum, where would you direct somebody?
I would just go to Facebook for all those things. I'm Sandra Keelan Burroughs on Facebook, and then of course the museum is Alabama's Music Hall of Fame on Facebook.
Awesome. Sandra, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for coming out and talking with me.
Oh my God, what a great morning.
Thank you.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
I'll be turning 33 next Friday morning. Friday morning 15 years ago, my grandfather called me to his bedside, and he told me there was something I should know. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy, the land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see. So I loaded up my car and moved to Denver to work a job and chase big city dreams. But I never found the life I really wanted till I came back home to Leaper's Fork, Tennessee. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see. It didn't hit me quite as hard then as those words come through today. But in the chaos all around me, I can still hear Grandpa say, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, and folks up there crying, the land will save you, wait and see.